Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I am Renee Coleman, sitting in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge, the heart of the Klimpire, with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man. What is going on with you?
I can't really say what I've been doing specifically, but I'm completely busy. I was out of town. I was in Florida with John Papa Grow Band, playing a couple of dates this past weekend. Just got back late last night.
And that's Papa Grow's Funk.
Well, that's the same guy. That's the keyboard player from Papa Grow's Funk. Yeah, yeah.
That was
a specific band of guys that kind of broke up maybe like, I don't know, six,
but
7, 8
John
years ago.
Grow.
John Grow, yeah, yeah. He's the keyboard player. And so this is the John Papa Grow Band. So
I get you. I think you should change that name.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's John Papa Grows Some Balls. You know, maybe that'll work.
Huh.
Did they grow any funk?
Yeah. Are they funky?
When is the funk in season to grow?
Well, again, this is not Papa Grow's Funk. That was a band that was other people that I was not in. Years
so what
in the
is
past.
This band?
This is John Papa Grow Band, or John Papa Grow, just under his name.
Oh, that's what it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's
the end.
So what happened to the funk?
Well, I don't know. I guess
they harvested it.
Yeah,
it
yeah. It's I mean, there's still some funk in there, but it's more of a singer songwriter sort of song oriented bunch of material rather than long extended jams or something. So
I gotcha.
That would be the difference.
Well, that sounds like a hell of a gig.
Well, it was interesting. Played a kind of a hippie festival on Saturday night. And now this is like hippies with $150,000 motor coaches, out in the forest, the pine forest outside of, I guess, Orlando or something. We show up and have a couple of stages, really nice, been going on for a couple of days. They're very organized, very accommodating. And as we're loading on stage, somebody comes up and says, "Look, let me know if you need anything at all." I'm like, "Okay." It's like they're talking about food or, equipment and stuff. But just the way they said that, it kind of caught my ear. I was like, okay, all right.
So you went back to your old days.
Well, so then at the end of the set, a different person is there and brought us some food. And then they repeat the thing, let me know if there's anything you need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know. It seems like one of those.
So this was the nephew of Jeffrey Epstein, right?
I'm not sure. I didn't check any.
Did you get anything?
No. Just
how about some funk? Say, hey, I want some funk.
Yeah, it's I was all full up. I had enough. I'd had enough funk already.
This is a guy who's got $1 million, whatever you call it, a coach. He's offering you something, mm-hmm. and you say no.
Well, it's I'm out there working, Manny, so...
You're working for 3 hours.
Yeah.
You got 21 hours left in the day.
Right.
There's plenty of stuff to do.
Okay.
And to take advantage of.
All right, Manny, well, I'll...
See, the best part of my life is taking advantage of people. So if someone offers you something, I would take it.
All right, well, I'll have to be quicker on the trigger next time.
Yeah.
Manny, what would you have asked for?
The world. I mean, he says anything you want.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Just the way it is,
I want, a fucking plate of heroin and two hookers, and then I want them to film me dancing in a field of lilies. He says anything you want.
Okay. Well, had I wanted that, I don't think there was a hot.
You know what I'm celebrating? I'm celebrating 20 years without heroin.
Okay.
Yeah, 20 years. The last 20 years ago was the last time I did heroin, around this time.
Okay, cool. I hope you do get to dance in a field of lilies
to celebrate.
I think that is like a really good
way
to mark
that anniversary.
If someone said,
I'll give you anything, what would you do if someone said, anything you need, anything you want?
Well, now I want to dance in a field of flowers. Now you just put that in my head.
Yeah.
Although maybe I would want like a small puppy.
I don't like animals, so that wouldn't help with
you.
Then
they should not give you one.
Yeah, no, don't give me any animals. Don't give me any puppies or anything like that. So anyway, you were in Florida, you grew some balls, and now you're back.
Now I'm back. Yes, I'm back.
And how does it feel to be back?
It's good to be back.
Yeah.
Back and better than ever. I actually did have a, I was out in a field on this trip, because the place I was staying.
A poppy field?
There's no poppies. No, it was actually a golf course. The place I'm staying, I've stayed there before, I've spoken about it, and these people's home backs up onto a golf course. Uh-huh. Now, when I was a kid living here in New Orleans in high school, if you went into Audubon Park on like Friday and Saturday nights as you're just walking across the golf course or the empty park.
High on heroin.
You'd see, we weren't really into dope at that time.
Okay.
It was more like psychedelics and weed and stuff.
Okay.
You'd see packs of teenagers walking across the golf course and the fields, meeting to get high and stuff. Anyway, so I like being out on the golf course at night. There's nobody there. You know, the fog's coming in. It's kind of like being on the moors or something. So I'll usually walk out and, you know, after everybody's gone to bed, and walk out in the golf course. I did that on this trip, and I was just walking around, you know, enjoying the night air, the moon. And then I realized, well, I'm not really sure where their house is from here. It's one of those houses. I don't think I've crossed the whole golf course.
So you
got
lost.
I got a little bit lost.
Alzheimer's is coming.
Walking
there, right?
Back and forth, thinking, I don't recognize that. Well, because, you know, like during the daytime, the house looks one way.
Yeah.
And then with the lights on, it looks a different way, because depending on what sections are lit up, it doesn't have the
now,
same appearance.
Now, what hole? Like the fourth hole, the eighth hole, the ninth hole?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't playing golf, so I have no idea what it was out there on the fairway. There were some.
Now, there's gators out there in those
traps.
Golf courses. You got to be careful, man.
Yeah, it was.
There's lots of gators out there.
I think this was a gated community. I don't think they had.
A gatored community?
Okay, very good. We like the wordplay.
Well, the gators. Gators aren't gated from the water.
Yeah.
Are they gating the water?
No, if it's a contained man-made lake, I guess, you know, they could walk to it or something, but they can't swim to that from the Everglades or anything.
Now,
anyway,
where was this in Florida?
It's the Orlando area.
Orlando.
Anyway, I did ultimately find my way back to the house without any assistance, so it all's well that ends well.
Did you get to go to Disney World?
I have gone to Disney World before when staying at these people's house because they actually work for Disney, but didn't go on this trip.
He's never taken his children to Disney World.
Oh, my God.
They've been. They went with somebody else.
But he never actually took them.
They didn't need me to bring them, you know.
Just gave them to some guy on the street.
No, no. Like, they worked it out.
Just some junkies on the street.
They worked it out on their own. Well, speaking of animals, Manny, I don't know if you do you have something else? Or you
no, no, go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, well, so this I wasn't aware of the story, but have become aware of it. Apparently, you know, there's this guy in the French Quarter, the Marigny, that has a bunch of exotic animals he drives around with, and this kind of three-wheeled bicycle, tricycle, I guess they call them. He's got like a rabbit and a couple of other weird things, and he has an opossum. And during Mardi Gras.
An opossum?
Well, yeah, that's what they are. It's around here. That's the official name. People will still call them possums, but opossum is the actual name.
Is that
of the
like
animal.
Burgundy as opposed to Burgundy?
It's an Irish possum.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Again, all with right. The wordplay, Allison, we like it. So the wildlife and fisheries agents were out patrolling the French Quarter in the Marigny. Why, I don't know. But they spotted him with the opossum. They said, you know, it's illegal to have a wild animal kept as a pet in Louisiana. So they...
good luck enforcing that.
They seized his opossum.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind
and
of...
they had it for dinner.
Well, they say that the animal is safe, although they won't tell him where it is. But
they're very scary animals. They're like frightening, those animals.
Well, you know,
opossums.
You know, that was when I heard that an opossum had been seized, I thought that it was this other animal that belonged to this woman that we met who had one as a pet. We actually met her the night at the Kingpin, the night that D.C. Harbold had his wedding party. She showed up there.
I wasn't there.
No, you weren't there.
You say we. Well, you kept saying we.
Me and D.C., my wife,
okay.
And
right.
Other people.
Well, you kept saying, I thought you meant
we,
I was
we,
there, too.
We, no, you weren't there.
Okay.
You were invited, but you didn't go. But
I didn't ever, you know, I'm going, I remember, I never got an invite.
Okay. Anyway, there was a woman there that had an opossum that she'd found, you know, as a little pup or something. It had fallen off its mother's back, and she had raised it as her own. So apparently there's not only one pet opossum in town, there's two. So I don't know.
Well, that's good.
It's become a cause.
So this person in the Marigny, they don't have their pet anymore.
They don't have their pet, but they have a big
now. Well,
petition
this person is using these animals to make money.
I don't think so. I'm not sure how this guy makes money. I think he might make some little trinkets and sell them. He seems to be living kind of a subsistence lifestyle from what I can tell.
Well, I really don't care about it.
Sure.
It's possum.
Okay, well,
you know what I was thinking?
Yes, please tell us.
I was thinking just the other day, you know, you always hear that phrase, he or she died before their time.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck does that mean? I don't even know what that means. You know, you're going to die, you're going to die.
Right. Whenever
before
you die,
your time.
Your, yeah. Whenever
yeah,
you die,
your
it's
time
your time
to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you died.
You know, because you're dead.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. So I never understand. Oh, they died before their time. I don't get that.
Okay.
I don't know. It's just something that was irking me the last 3 years.
Okay. Glad you finally got to get that
I
off
finally
your chest.
Remembered it. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, but also I want to. You know, we talked about Mardi Gras last week and mm-hmm. how we were. At Michael Deese's house for a little while.
Yes.
And then I saw that he was on the CBS Morning Show, and the fucking guy doesn't even mention us. Doesn't mention me or you at all. Fuck him, man.
Yeah, I think you know that what? Was that had already been taped.
Yeah,
and they actually he didn't go into any details about his Mardi Gras Day entertaining.
And it seemed like
mostly about the stamps, mostly about his stamp
his
portraits
stamps.
And the new Ruth Bader Ginsburg stamp that he painted that just came out recently. So that's really the focus of
but
the
whole
piece. But
he looked very ill during that interview. He seemed like he was coughing a lot.
Yeah,
he seemed congested and nasal and stuff like that's just what the wife and I noticed.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't mention us, so fuck him. You know, that's basically the way I feel.
Okay, I'm sorry you feel that way, man.
Still, he's a good guy.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Still, we still love Michael. He's so talented.
Yeah.
So he's so kind to us.
Is he?
Yes.
What has he ever done for us?
Oh, well, he had us to his house on Mardi Gras Day. That was pretty nice.
I never got an invite. You just snuck me into the house. You said, oh, yeah, it's cool.
You were welcome. He was happy
really?
To see you, yes.
Really?
Michael is kindly disposed towards you, Manny.
All right.
Anyway. Okay. If you've got
another thing I don't understand,
okay,
you know, is you know this whole like you know they died before their time
mm-hmm.
is I don't understand when someone says you know when they're pouring so say when, what does that mean say when? Why don't you just say stop? You know you're pouring something or you're doing say when? I don't understand what that means.
Say when to stop.
Why don't you just say stop?
Well, you know, it reminds me of this other speech affect or thing that people do, and it's usually people from the Midwest. They'll say, I'm going somewhere, do you want to go with? As opposed to, do you want to go with me? And I always thought that struck me as weird. Do you want to go with? With, what do you mean go with what? Go with what?
With time. God. That's
go
what they
with
mean.
God. Sure, yeah.
They want you to know you want to go with
so
God.
So it catches my ear.
Yeah.
Strange.
Well, it's the Bible Belt, right? Is that what you're talking about? The Bible Belt area?
The Midwest? No.
I think this is the. Well, we're like a little below it, but this is the Bible Belt.
We're below
belt.
Everything down here.
Bible Belt's like, you know, Memphis through all that midsection there.
No, this state is below pretty much everything.
I thought the died
below
before
the
their time thing was leading up to another opossum joke. Because that's what they do. They pretend that they died before their time.
There you go.
Very
but
good.
Then when you're not looking, they leave.
Some penetrating analysis from
about
our guest.
About opossums, yeah.
We love it. We love it. It's, why hold back?
There's one thing I wanted. One more last thing before our guest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wife and I, we don't go out much. We like to watch movies and stuff. But we watched... last night or the night before, we watched the movie, the Sofia Coppola movie, Priscilla. Have you seen it?
I have seen it.
Yeah. It was all right. Yeah, I think she's a good filmmaker, you know. I think she's a better writer than filmmaker. But I like her a lot. And I just thought to myself, okay, this is like the millionth movie that had Elvis in it. And, You know, you've had people over the years like Kurt Russell play Elvis, Nicolas Cage do Elvis, and so many other actors do Elvis, you know? Mm-hmm. And the guy who was in that movie, I don't remember his name, he was doing Elvis. And I thought to myself, you know who did the best Elvis in film history, if you ask me, personally, if you ask me, was Jodie Foster. She did the best Elvis in Silence of the Lambs. Because that's all she was doing was, Dr. Lecter, Dr. Lecter, Dr. Lecter. Yeah, Dr. Lecter, sure. She did the best Elvis. Because all she was doing was Elvis in that movie.
Okay.
You know? And now I thought to myself, you know, I thought, she is the best Elvis, Jodie Foster.
That's a pretty brave take. Do you think Elvis would have been a good FBI agent?
I have no idea.
Well, he liked the idea. He got Nixon to give him a badge.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he got
badge.
A star.
Yeah.
I think he would have been a better Dr. Lecter.
I think that's actually probably true. Yeah.
You know, he'd eat anything, that guy. You know. So I was just, I thought the movie was okay.
I'll have to check that out. I saw it. It's available.
Yeah, it's Priscilla's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and apparently she's still alive, right?
No, she. Oh, yeah, she is.
She's alive.
Still alive.
But her daughter, Lisa Marie died.
Passed away. Yeah. That's right. Sad to lose your husband and your child. Oh man.
Yeah.
Lived a hard life, that Priscilla.
Maybe that's exactly what she's been looking.
What a strange life.
Yeah.
Can you
crazy.
Imagine that was her parents, kind of. Where they were like, well, hey, you can go live with this adult man in his house, and we're going to be in Europe, and you're just like, okay.
Yeah. And the movie showed, I mean, it was weird, because then she goes to live with him in Memphis, and he's out doing movies, and no, you can't come, because I'm banging Anne Margaret. I'm doing this with, you know, so-and-so and stuff. And she's sitting at Graceland with a dog, you know.
They wanted to keep her back there unspoiled.
Yeah. What I did like about the film, though, was Elvis's entourage. He just had all these guys constantly around him, and they were just like yes guys. Right. Oh yeah, oh yes, E, yeah, okay, E, okay, E. You know, they were
Sonny and Red, the Memphis Mafia. Yeah.
Yeah, those guys. You know,
well, that was one of the only movies that made it look like that was even a little bit fun.
Yeah,
actually. Like
exactly.
At least those guys were having fun.
Yeah,
no
yeah.
one else was.
No, she wasn't.
She wasn't.
And I don't think Elvis was. He was just. You know, especially after his mama died and stuff like that, you know. But, yeah, it's a good film. Trouble Nation, check it out. Let us know what you think. You know, Jodie Foster or Kurt Russell Elvis. Who's better?
Okay. You know? All right. Challenge to the Trouble Nation out
there.
All right, well, very good. Well, let's get our guest in here.
Sure.
Okay.
What's that? I said hi.
Hi. Oh, no, we got to hold on. I got a big build up to the letdown here. So our guest, she's an award-winning arts and culture writer, radio show host on WWOZ. Her work has appeared in all kind of places, New York Times, Rolling Stone, Vice, NPR, Pitchfork. She was the music critic for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and Gambit magazine here in town. She's a founding program director for the Ponderosa Stomp Foundation, and her collection of New Orleans hip-hop and bounce oral histories, Where They At, was presented as a multimedia exhibit that toured internationally and is now in part of the permanent collection at Tulane's Amistad Research Center. And she's currently working on a book on New Orleans cartoonist and painter, local icon Bunny Matthews, the creator of Vic and Natalie series. She's working on that book. Is that for, I believe, the New Orleans, Historic New Orleans Collection, I believe.
Yes, Historic New Orleans Collection.
So we're going to get into all that and much more, but without further ado, the great Miss Allison Fensterstock. Welcome, Allison.
Okay, now is when I say hi.
Now is when you
hi.
Say hi, that's
hey.
Right.
Yeah.
You've done this before.
Oh, yeah.
You have a lot of radio experience. You have a lot of interview experience, a lot of panel experience.
I've talked to some people. Like a few.
You're much better at this than we are. So.
I interviewed you before you interviewed me.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Now, you interviewed me for about Carville.
Yeah, about the leprosarium in Carville.
Leprosarium. We like that word.
I know, isn't
word.
That a good word?
It's a great word. It's better than a leper colony. That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, know. Which apparently, and now it's they call it Hansen's disease.
Sure, sure.
And they do still treat everyone with everyone in the U.S. with Hansen's disease does have to go to Baton Rouge.
Oh, okay.
For the most.
That doesn't sound good.
For the best treatment.
Right.
But they don't. But they don't have to live in the weird plantation
on campus. Yeah, they closed. Yeah, they closed the campus down. Well, even at the time when I played there, some people still lived on site, but a lot of people lived in the town and would just go there for treatment.
Yeah, no, there was a point at which, like, it was so treatable that you didn't have to be isolated.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many people at that point who had been in the leprosarium
right.
for their whole adult lives that they didn't really have anything to go back to, so they just stayed there.
That's what they knew. That was their community. That was their life, sure.
Yeah, and they didn't really lock
them
down.
It's like prison.
Except you could, well...
You know, people who go to prison for 40 years and then they get let go out into society in the 41st year, they have no idea.
They don't know what to do. Yeah, they're institutionalized. Yeah, they don't know what to do.
They don't know what to do.
And that there are like a bunch of, there are some nonprofits even here that are there specifically to help people. I think there's the place, the First 72, which is kind of near the courthouse, that also has really good Friday fish fries during Lent. And
okay.
they help people who have gotten out of prison after very, very long
Well, we don't do
terms.
Lent. Renee and I don't do Lent. So, but people do.
Some people do.
I'm Jewish.
Right. So
yeah.
You're not doing Lent either.
You're not doing Lent.
But, so yeah, we switched to the reentry idea. We cascaded right from Hansen's disease to post-incarceration.
Now, who is Hansen?
I don't know. It was like a guy with a disease. No,
yeah, he was a leper.
Maybe he discovered it or something. The doctor that isolated the bacteria that bacterium.
I feel like I knew at the point that I interviewed you, and then I.
Well, I'm not sure if you told me this or if I just discovered it subsequent to that interview. But it turned out that I graduated from high school with a girl whose father was one of the doctors for his many, many years of his career at Carville. And I think she might have lived on site for when she was real, real little. But then even after she didn't live there anymore, she would still go there to get, like that was for doctor visits, just for regular doctor visits.
And also, you know what they did there? I'm sorry, but I think the Carville is still super interesting to me. Like one of the biggest... discoveries they made there was in orthopedic shoes, because with leprosy, with Hansen's disease, it's not that parts of your body fall off, it's that you get numbness in your extremities.
So you tend to get injured.
Yeah, and you're much more likely to get hurt, so you'll lose toes.
Oh.
So the doctors at Carville, like, invented all of these, like, really ingenious ways to make special shoes for people that had no feeling.
And that was Dr. Scholl?
could be. That's
okay.
We don't have any information on that. Okay, well, very good, Allison. Well, we're so happy to have you here. We obviously have lots of things to talk about, but let's get some background on you. So you didn't grow up in New Orleans. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City.
Okay, what part of New York City?
On the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
Okay.
Right by the Guggenheim Museum.
Oh, nice. Nice. Must have enjoyed living in...
Yeah, no, I think the best way to live in New York City is to be a child.
Okay.
Because otherwise it's way too expensive.
Yeah.
But as like a kid and a teenager, especially in the 90s, you just had like a subway token. I was going to say Metro card, but there weren't Metro cards yet when I was a kid. And you could just like run around. I hung out in the park. I went to museums a lot. We went to the movies a lot.
Just by yourself or you and your friends?
Me and my friends. Uh-huh. You know,
we were allowed to be feral out there running around Manhattan.
We were like, and it was probably safer.
The 90s? It was in the 90s?
Yeah, late 90s, before Giuliani, before he locked it all down, so it wasn't, like, freakishly safe.
Because I remember living in New York in the mid-80s, and it was still, like, towards the tail end of taxi driver days.
Right.
You know, and then I moved back to L.A., where I'm from, and then I came back to New York in the early 90s, and it was getting Disneyfied like crazy.
Like literally Disneyfied.
Yeah.
Because they cleaned out Times Square.
Yeah, and
the Disney
there was no smell of urine anymore in the subway.
And you missed that.
And right? I kind of did because I love the movie Taxi Driver, and I just kind of loved it because I was there in like 86, 87, and it just still had that stench, you know, Studio 54 stench and everything. And then when I went back in the early 91, it was gone. It was like, what happened, man? Yeah, where are the rats?
That was like probably right when I was allowed to like go out of the house because I was 13.
Okay, yeah, okay, yeah. So.
And I remember when Times Square changed over basically overnight because they... I'm not going to get the facts right, but I do remember they closed kind of every porn shop and every storefront
at once.
Yeah,
those were gone. Sexatoria, yeah. Fantastics, and all that.
And
was
they
gone.
Sold a lot of them to mostly Disney, and now there's like an M&M store and all these like
which are
weird
still there
Las
today,
Vegas
yeah.
style stores. Yeah, yeah, but in the interim, all the porn store marquees, they let art students at Parsons and SVA take over the marquees and the storefronts.
Oh, cool.
And I had some older friends that were in art school, and I remember going there late at night to see what they had done. And they had just put up, you know, weird 90s artsy teenager art in all these, you know, this ghost town of Times Square. And it was amazing. This was like 1992, 93.
Okay, yeah.
So you went to elementary school there, high school in Manhattan?
Yeah, no, I went all the way up through high school in Manhattan. I got to go to Columbia a little bit at the end of high school because, like, I think if you finished all your high school requirements early, you could go to Columbia or NYU.
Nice.
Now, so that was another 90s loose children in New York.
Sure, sure. Thing. Now, the Dalton School, is that the high school you went to?
Yeah.
Now, tell us about the Dalton School. I should have done some research today, but it sounds like something.
Before, I mean... Long before I went there, Jeffrey Epstein was a teacher at the Dalton School.
Okay, so, see, I knew.
Just, it's a callback to your, right?
Yes,
your brief mention earlier.
Well, I'm glad you didn't take his class.
Okay, no, I think he was already like hanging out with Prince Andrew on like an island by the time I was in high school.
Oh, okay.
No, it was like a small, fancy private school for artsy kids. Sean Lennon went there when I was there.
Oh, okay, friends with him?
Kind of.
Okay. Now, were you interested in writing? Were you already writing at that time in high school?
Well, yeah. I mean, I wrote for like the high school literary poetry magazine. I hope no one ever finds any of that.
Well, we all got to start somewhere, right? Yeah. Now, music, your interest, were you already going out to see a ton of bands? And
yeah. I mean, well, I guess that's another thing that was probably similar growing up in New Orleans, I think. You could get into a lot of shows.
Yes, yes.
There was a lot happening, and if you were mobile, you could go to either all-ages shows, or no one really cared if you went into not all-ages shows. But I was like a teenage hippie, and we went to the Wetlands a lot, which was sort of the jam band place. I remember seeing Ani DeFranco a lot. She's like 4 or 5 years older than me.
Uh-huh.
She was just starting to play. We went to the New Eurekan Poets Cafe a lot, like the slam poetry scene of the 90s. We were just kind of like kids on the loose, like actually being surprisingly cultured. I mean, like definitely like smoking pot and stuff, but doing the kind of things that I think you would maybe want your teenage children to do, like,
what did
you do for the past 6 hours when I didn't know where you were? Like, well, actually, like, I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art because it's pay what you wish.
You weren't scrounging around in Alphabet City.
Well, I mean, we were, like, to, you know...
You were doing tar heroin.
See bands. I mean, I think Alex McMurray was playing there when I was a teenager. He was part of that, like, anti-folk scene on Avenue A.
Okay,
which was also all ages. There's like quite a few people in New Orleans.
You're younger than Alex? Okay.
Yeah, like maybe 5 years or so.
Okay.
But that's the thing. There's like people like Ani and Alex, and maybe like Dana Kurtz, who were just like a little bit older than me, but they were already adult enough to play shows.
Right.
And I was like
a kid
going to see them, but they seemed very grown up and accomplished to me.
Nice, nice. So you graduate from high school. You now I know you wind up going to Tulane. How did that happen?
That was really random. I applied to all these like really small liberal arts schools, like Oberlin. And then at the last minute, I freaked out and decided that I didn't want to live in the woods. So I applied to NYU and I got in and I just went there. And then after my freshman year at NYU, I came down here for the summer with a friend of mine and I was 19 and I was like, you know what? I think I'll just live here. Like there's a college here.
That was the first time you'd been in New Orleans. So,
yeah.
Okay.
We were just like, I think this seems like a good idea. I've read about this place somewhere. I mean, I was probably like reading Jack Kerouac or something as a 16-year-old.
And did your friend stay down here too or no?
Yeah, we spent that first summer here.
But did go to school down here too? Did she go to school down here too?
Well, she actually like went back up to New York to go to college and then came here to go to grad school at UNO with me later on. And then she married someone from here. So she comes back a lot. So that she also got entangled in New Orleans. But literally I was just like, oh, I have found another place that I would like to live. There's a college here. I'll see if I can go there.
Okay, so it wasn't like you're up in New York thinking, oh yeah, Tulane, Northeastern Jews go down there and have a big party.
Not at all. Like okay. That was also really funny when I got there and I realized it had that reputation for right, all the like, Jews from New York going there. And I was like, oh. Like I literally just
I work at Tulane. It's all the Jews who couldn't get into the Ivy League schools up north that come down here.
Well, also people that just want to get out of that climate. They want to be away from their parents. They want to be down in the South. You know, New Orleans is an attractive place.
Is it?
Maybe they don't want to work so hard.
No, yeah. I didn't really know anything about it. I just decided I wanted to like live really far away from New York. And I was here and I liked it. And I was like, there's a college up there. I think I'll go there. And I wasn't like, again, I was not a very like monitored young person. So my family was like, sure. Yeah, go there.
Okay. So you get down to New Orleans, you start digging into the culture here. What do you think about that? And it's like, you know, it's such an insular place here. Were you familiar with the, New Orleans vernacular or, you know, our musical heritage before you came down here?
Not anything beyond what anyone else reading like underground literature would know. Okay. And that's like totally teenager in the 90s underground literature, like reading all the beat poets and stuff. And
right.
And also like there was really no internet and there was no like way to easily figure out what was going on that was cool. I had to go find flyers in the coffee shops. And Tulane at the time, which I don't know if you sort of have observed that the way Tulane has evolved out of that or Marion has, but Tulane in the 90s was like, don't look at the city outside of Tulane.
Yeah,
like,
try to keep them cloistered.
Yeah, there's like one class in the history of New Orleans. I think there's like one.
Oh, it's still that way.
No, now they have the Gulf South Center. You know,
yeah, but
they
it's
have
still
a lot
that way. The president, what's his name, Fitz, when he took over, it's like, we don't want to do this New Orleans brand. We're doing Tulane brand. So anything that, you know, had to do with like, you know, all the programs for the incoming freshmen and all that kind of, you know, they didn't talk about, you know, you're not riding the streetcar. You're not going down here. You're not doing this. It's all about Tulane's the brand. New Orleans is not the brand. And he's been very successful in many ways. Doing that because guy can fucking raise money, man.
Yeah,
it's still better than the 90s, though.
Well, I wasn't here in the 90s.
Well, I remember trying to find some kind of class to take on New Orleans music, and they had one history of jazz class, and that was it. And there wasn't even like a history of New Orleans music class, there was like a history of pop music class. And these were for non-music majors,
but I
don't think there was anything better for people that actually played instruments. And then the guy that taught the history of jazz class, when I became a grown-up and started talking to musicians, everyone makes fun of that guy.
Yeah.
They'd be like, oh, God, that guy. Huh, you took his class? And I'm like, well, okay, no
yeah,
wonder.
Yeah, well, this is an old saw about people teaching stuff, right? So you're down here. You go through Tulane. Now, I know you're big into you did this whole oral history of New Orleans hip-hop and bounce. Were you starting to go out to these bounce shows and stuff, in that era?
I wasn't then.
Okay.
Because I feel like I'm not even sure if, and this is like a combination of probably like me being stupid and things not being readily available, but I wasn't really listening to OZ. I definitely wasn't really listening to Q93. And like that time period was when all this music was happening. And I did have friends that had grown up here that had tapes, and we would listen to bounce music. Mm. And I did start to get to know, I mean, you know, these like massive looming names like Alan Toussaint or Ernie Cato, or it would have been hard to not know about that. But I think I had definitely graduated before I really started to learn about local music like that, which I know, like, I feel stupid now, but I'm just like, I don't know. I was 19 and there was no Instagram. And
Right.
I was just on campus. I did. I mean, I went and saw The Rebirth on Tuesdays at the Maple Leaf. I got like a small amount of culture. I went to Tipitina's a lot, but the shows I really remember seeing there are like, I saw Morphine there.
Oh, cool.
I saw Funkadelic there, which is like definitely like a college thing to do.
Yeah,
get into Parliament Funkadelic.
Sure.
Yeah. Your first writing job here is what? Where do you get hired? Is that Gambit?
Probably Gambit. If I'm going to be really honest, I will have to say it was Where You At.
Oh, okay.
That was my friend Michael. No, it wasn't Michael Jastro. It was Jamie Bernstein, who is now.
Oh, I know Jamie Bernstein.
Singer, songwriter.
Yeah, I used to play music with him. I used to play in his band for a bit. Yeah, he's a good guy.
He was the first editor of Where You At.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. I forget how I met him, but I was like, you know, writing for the Tulane Literary Magazine again, like writing like goofy little poems and having like poetry readings in Pocket Park by the PJs. And somehow I met Jamie and he was like, you know, like, yeah, you can review CDs and we'll give you like $10 and a free CD. And I was like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So I did that for a while. And then I started working for Gambit, which I think I just emailed Gambit and was like, can I come write things for you?
So email was happening then.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a laptop that weighed like 30 pounds.
Oh, so what year is this now? What year is this?
Well, like, late '90s? In like 1999.
Okay.
I graduated in 2000.
Okay. So you had the computers are happening.
Yeah. I had a Toshiba Tekra laptop that it was so hard to pick up and carry anywhere. It was like portable and name only. But yeah, I was definitely like, I don't know. And you know what? I only had that at the end of college. Because I remember having to type all my papers in the computer lab in the student center.
Okay.
On campus. Now, and at the women's center on campus, which is one of the best resources at Tulane, Caroline Richardson Hall.
Oh, okay. Right on. So was Michael Tisserand at Gambit at that time?
Yeah, that was like the golden era of Gambit when it was like the extra large tabloid size. Mm-hmm. And it was like an inch thick. It had like great music writing and film and books and these like 4,000 word cover stories, like super alt weekly style, like magazine feature writing.
Right.
I think it's the first place I ever read Katie Rechdahl, you know, and she blew my mind. And I was just really excited to get to write, you know, 100 word blurb on a band coming to town.
Right. And you stayed there for several years, huh? It must have been a great training ground for you, huh?
Well, yeah, I was freelancing. Like, I didn't have a job there, but I was contributing stuff. Alex Rawls was the music editor. Mm-hmm. I think I did that on and off after I graduated while I was in grad school until Katrina. And then when they came back after Katrina, they took away the music editor job as, like, a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
So Alex went to Offbeat, to run Offbeat, which is, like, I don't know if that's like a good idea for anyone, but he did it.
Right.
And then I agreed to just do that job like without health insurance and benefits because I was like 27.
Sure. Well, so it was prescient because you were already adapting to the new gig economy where everybody was going to operate with no job security or health insurance.
I should have known this. This was like how, you know, writing about the arts would only continue to like get less remunerative over time.
Right, right. I'm sure you know Rick Olivier, Rico. Mm-hmm. He tells a story about in the early days of they had computerized typesetting, mm-hmm. and they're sitting around a table of all photographers, writers, illustrators, and they're all bemoaning, "Oh, it's so sad that this is putting computers are putting typesetters out of business."
Yeah.
He said, "Little did we know, we were all typesetters. Everybody at that table was gonna go through the same thing in the next 10 years. You know, it's all gonna be demonetized."
You know, over this weekend, the Historic New Orleans Collection, they do like a historical symposium every year. That's like a whole day of presentations. That's something about Louisiana history. Mm-hmm. And this year it was newspapers.
Uh-huh.
So it was all these different academics presenting on historical newspaper stuff. But one of them, who did a really interesting presentation about like a dramatic historical kidnapping from the middle of the 19th century, okay. was saying that when something like when a really hot news story like a kidnapping was happening, they would put out those extras, you know, like extra, read all about
right,
it.
Right, right.
The morning paper, the afternoon paper, and the extra.
Yeah.
But they had to typeset all of those updates, you know, letter by letter, super mm-hmm. fast. And the typesetters became like mini celebrities.
Yeah.
He was showing these ads that they would have demonstrations to be like fast typesetting contest, like,
oh,
and that was entertainment to come watch like a dude. You know,
well, yeah, I mean that's insane because I was in junior high and I took a print shop class, you know, once a and we, you know, you had to do that stuff, and at the end of the semester, you basically made a rubber stamp with your name and address on your business card, and that shit is hard.
Oh,
that
yeah.
shit was fucking hard to do.
Yeah, like imagine you're getting out 3 papers a day.
Yeah.
And then you have to include all the time it takes to like report the story and call it in, or you know, it's if it's the middle of the 19th century, you're probably like racing back to the newspaper office on your horse
sure.
or something. And then you have to like go to the typesetter, and then he has to pull a million little tiny metal letters out of his drawer. Like that's a lot of hours. That's like different than me like having my, you know, my phone and writing something in an email and tapping it,
right.
you know.
It's a lot of cigarettes, I bet, too.
Yeah.
And then you go on to write for the Times-Picayune. I think you were there during a very interesting time period that I want to get into. But right now, it seems like a good time to take a break, man.
Yeah, where it's our halfway point, Allison. And the troubled nation knows the drill. We'll be right back.
I'm tossing and I'm turning all in my sleep. Listen to me. All through the night, my love, all I do is weep. Listen to the beating of my heart, beating like a tom-tom, 'cause I had you on my mind. Do this, oh, oh. Listen to the beating. The beating of my heart. Beating like a tom-tom, 'cause I had you on my mind. Sometimes I get tired of you and don't know just what to do. Simply 'cause
we're back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Coleman, back with our guest, Ms. Allison Fensterstock. Now, Allison, I know you're kind of new to the program. You may not be aware that we're still operating as a kind of a listener-supported model. So we have a PayPal link and a Venmo link for the young people there in the show notes of every show, as well as the Facebook page that we have there, the pinned Facebook page. We also have a Patreon page, and we have a handful of patrons who are there with us week in and week out. And the link to the Patreon page is right there in the show notes as well. And it takes all the guesswork out of supporting the Troubled Men podcast. Anyway, beyond that, we have the Troubled Men podcast t-shirts that are available in all the most popular sizes and styles. Follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook. Rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps us out a lot. Costs you nothing. Let's see. Dates. I have a date with Ed Volker of the Radiators doing a solo thing. He's got the trio Mollusk. I'll be playing with that on, Saturday, March the 9th at Chickiwawa. 8 o'clock, so everybody check that out. And again, I'll be going out with the Iguanas later March. The Iguanas and Sonny Landreth doing a co-bill tour going all through the Midwest for a couple of weeks, and then we're going up to the Northeast right after like the end of May, middle of May, for a second leg of that tour. So if you can find all those dates at iguanas.com, check those out.
All right, enough.
Enough of that. All right.
All right.
Back to our guest, Ms. Allison Fensterstock. So, Allison, we were when we last left you, we were talking about your work there at Gambit.
I started being the music writer at the Gambit right after Katrina when it came back, because Gambit didn't publish for a few months after the storm. They were on Bienville Street. They got like 13 feet of water or something.
Yes.
They came back in... No, was it 2006 already?
It was 2006. It was maybe the very end of
2005. Maybe. So yeah, I started doing the music column and all the recommended shows of the week and like, you know, cover stories sometimes and features. And by around 2008, the Times-Picayune asked me to come do the same thing for them, which was like also not have a full-time job and write like a bunch of stories a week, and it paid marginally better. And Gambit had just like shrunk a little bit. I don't know if you guys remember that, but that's Gambit
used to... It's about 3 pages now.
Right.
But it also, like, it used to be the size of like a full Village Voice.
Yeah. Just the page sizes got smaller. The page count got smaller. The whole thing shrunk, yes.
And it seemed like, I mean, like looking back to, again, this is all like... This, like, all actually seems like really bad harbingers of the future for everybody.
Right.
But at the time, it seemed like the Times-Picayune was a better option than Gambit.
The Times-Picayune was still a daily newspaper at this time, right?
Yeah, they did say, they were like, oh, we'll, like, give you enough work that it'll be sort of like a full-time job.
Just without benefits.
Without benefits. Right. And I think also at the time, I was still living... I had like a studio apartment by Port-au-Call, and it was like $400 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, that's cool.
Sure.
So, yeah, and I didn't realize that I was, and I'm not even sure if I'm like particularly qualified to talk about that time at the Times-Picayune, because I was a latecomer to the drama.
Okay, well,
that,
I can tell
that
the story.
Ensued.
Okay.
Although I was actually more of like a middlecomer to the drama that ensued, because I have a lot of friends that came on there after the 2012 Times-Picayune bloodbath, and I was a little bit before. I went over there in 2009, so there were like 3 really weird years.
So the newspaper got bought by an outside. Was that like a hedge fund or something?
No. Oh, that was not what happened in 2012.
Okay.
That was it was already owned by Advance Publications, which is a...
They just basically cut things, right?
Yeah, it was kind of like a preemptive strike, because it was a very large newspaper company that owned, I think, 13 small and medium-sized newspapers around the country, like in like Mobile,
right,
Ann Arbor, Michigan, mm-hmm. and Portland and Cleveland.
Right.
And they wanted to make them more profitable because they were just like bleeding money.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they decided that the Times-Picayune would be a really good test newspaper to try this out on, which was bizarre because based on the information that I have, which again, like someone might write a comment on your website.
We had higher subscription rates than all those other papers. We had better, you know.
No. Yeah, it had tremendous. It had like the highest market penetration.
Right.
Of any of their newspapers, and it also had like the lowest internet usage of like any of their newspapers.
Makes sense.
But for some reason, and also this is something I think they didn't talk about when they were defending the decision or when people were kind of explaining the decision, but it was also, it's like New Orleans and people are obsessed with heritage brands. So
sure.
The Times-Picayune is like a Schwegman or a KMB, and like people got really upset when they were like, you're taking away our Times-Picayune, which like they weren't quite doing that.
Well, to cut to the chase, they got rid of a lot of columnists, a lot of writers. They cut the newspaper to 4 days a week.
I think it was three.
Okay, three. I thought they had three regular days and then a Sunday newspaper, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't remember. But
and my neighbor got, you know, Chris Waddington.
Yeah,
he's my neighbor. He got let go too.
And he was like the smartest person writing for the Times.
He's peculiar. He's very peculiar.
Had a lot of great writers.
Yeah.
And during so then they closed down the Times-Picayune, main headquarters that had been there forever. Ultimately wind up moving to Canal Place, right? I had a friend who worked for him for years before that, actually still works for him. But during the time, he said, I used to write for a newspaper, and now I write for a website in a shopping mall.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have heard that. No, and I think that was a psyop in a weird way, because
go ahead.
when they were still printing the paper, and I remember like, in 2009, when I was getting pseudo-hired for my pseudo-job, the woman that hired me took me up to this walkway above the presses and was like, look at that. That's where we make the paper.
Because mm-hmm.
she knew it would kind of blow my mind. And then you saw this giant press going like chunk, chunk, chunk. And, you know, it's like in a movie
it's
coming off the press.
Yeah, sure.
And it makes you feel like you're part of something.
Stop the presses?
No, I should have said that. I should have just said that like that first day.
Yeah, just yell it out.
Stop the presses.
But so when they moved to Canal Place, which I think was an entirely visual move, and again, this is me not with insider information.
Mm-hmm.
This is my read on it.
Right.
They were like, you know what? What will make people think that we're like a really modern digital publication is if we are at the top of a skyscraper. And so they moved everyone that was like a writer or an editor to Canal Place, and then everyone that did production was still back on Howard Avenue,
okay.
where the presses were.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember even at the time, I was like, this is a really weird psyop because they want us to feel divorced from making a paper.
Mm, okay.
Like they don't want our brains to think the work we're doing is connected to a physical newspaper.
Interesting.
And I still don't feel like... There are a lot of people who are still very mad about, like, we don't have our 7 days newspaper, or, like, John George saved us because he gave us a 7 days newspaper. And I'm like, I don't know. You know, it's the 21st century. Like, whether you're feeling physical paper or not is kind of moot. But it was like a weird psychological operation on everybody.
Yeah, well, I still get the newspaper. 7 days a week, so you know it's. I like to hold on to these conventions as long as possible. It connects me to.
You get the news so fast from anything now that newspapers to me are obsolete.
But it's too fast, you know. That's the thing. A newspaper allows you to sit there and pore over it.
I know, but you know, everyone's already read that. You know, the night before, and you're just reading about it.
And you're
bringing it up to somebody, and they're like, "That's old news, Renee."
I'm getting a more in-depth take on it than I believe they are from their news feed that they're scrolling.
Well,
through.
I mean, you can get the Times-Picayune on the web, and you get the same story.
I understand.
The night before,
sure. Yeah, and everything comes out online first.
Yeah,
and that's the case across the board with like every news outlet everywhere.
Did you know Keith O'Brien?
I don't think so.
He wrote for the Times-Picayune. He's a great writer, and he wrote this great story about my first run for mayor for the Times-Picayune. And he won a Pulitzer for it. He won a local Pulitzer Prize for it, which was great. And now he just wrote a book about Pete Rose, Charlie Hustle.
Nice.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. So anyway.
So you're working there when they move you to Canal Place, and then are you still there when John Georges buys the newspaper and goes back to being 7 days a week? You had moved on by that time.
Yeah, no, I got the big layoff, like the big cataclysmic layoff, was in 2012, and that was actually before I had a full time job there. Mm-hmm. So I was me and actually and Chris Waddington and I think both, Todd Price. Yeah. We were all arts writers that were kind of permalancers or stringers.
Yeah.
Like we worked there, like that was the only place locally that we worked. I think at the time too they said you can't freelance anywhere else, you just work for us. And if they had said that to me now, I would be like, well, you can't say that without giving me a job. But sure. I didn't know, and I was like, okay.
They just bullied you into it. Right.
And it was the same with Chris and Todd. So in 2012, they fired a million people.
Yeah.
They fired a million people, and then the three of us wound up having our jobs turned to full-time with benefits out of that change.
Oh,
so
wow.
we were the weirdly lucky ones.
Huh. Okay.
And then in 2015 they did another big layoff, not quite as big, and they laid off maybe 40 people, and Chris and I, that was when we got cut.
Yeah.
Now, when you were still working for the newspaper, you wrote an article, I can't remember what the whole point of it was, but in it you told a story that I found so charming, and it reminded me of something that I would have done or I have done. Go ahead.
This is my dad's second wife. My dad and his second wife had two kids that are a lot younger than me. Mm. And they wound up going to Catholic school because my dad's second wife is Catholic. And one of my younger half-sister's classmates was the younger sister of a woman named Stephanie Germanotta, who at the time was a student at NYU Tisch, and she was doing like jazz piano, and we actually went and saw her at, I think it was the Bottom Line, and she was amazing. Like, she had a killer voice, and she had long black hair, and she was beautiful, and I remember I was there as the sort of like adult child, like, to a sort of like semi outside the family unit, you know, and they're all like, oh, I don't know, like, she doesn't want to go back to college, she thinks that she can really make it in the music industry, like, oh, Allison, you've been like writing about music, you know, I've been working at the Times-Picayune for like 3 years, like, dude, what do you think she should do? And I was like, I don't know, it's really, you know, I don't think it's gonna work. I mean, that's like a really tall order. I don't think it's gonna,
it's really tough business.
I don't think it's gonna happen. Like, I think she should finish NYU.
Yeah, stay in school.
And that young woman, Stephanie Germanotta, is Lady Gaga.
I love that story.
So no one should ever ask me like what horse to bet on or like.
Well, I think I still.
So that's your half sister?
No, it's my half sister.
They know the family.
School with her sister.
I think it's still solid advice. Even knowing the end of the story, I think you were well within. You gave her solid advice, you know. And I always say, if people hear this solid advice and say I'm going to do it anyway, well, that's what it's going to take. So that's actually a good filter. So it is good advice. You know, it's like when you want to convert to Judaism, they go, no, don't. Please don't. You know, like they.
I mean, they make it really hard.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying
like on
so.
On purpose, right? We make it really hard on purpose.
Yes,
like,
exactly. So that so people who wind up converting, they don't do it on a whim. You know, it's like this. So similarly, this is good advice. You know, and she pursued in spite of your waving her off, and she's done fine. She's had a.
Probably every time she gets up in an arena in front of 20,000 people, she says, Allison Fensterstock was wrong. That's probably what she's thinking about. Like,
anyway, well, that's, that really made me like you. Not only that it happened, but that you told the story. I was like, all right, that charms me. So let's get up to today. And so now you're doing this Bunny Matthews, the sainted Bunny Matthews here in New Orleans.
Sainted.
He's a beloved character here in New Orleans. You know, Vic and Natalie. Vic and Natalie. For those who don't know, it's a cartoon that involved people from Chalmette, Araby, Lower Ninth Ward, wherever you want to. It's those people, like everybody in my family on my father's side. That's what they were like. They have the thick New Orleans accents, and they have this very working class take. And Bunny wrote this column for years and years, and it was everybody in New Orleans identified with it. So, and you and Michael Tisserand are writing a book. So tell, now that I've told some, you tell even more about Bunny.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, it may have started, I didn't realize that it was starting then, but at kind of close to the end of Bunny's life, I don't know how much either of you talked to him in kind of the early 20-teens. There was a period when he was retired, and he was on the internet a lot, and he was going out to lunch a lot and sending people emails a lot and kind of thinking about what his life had been. And this was also before he became ill, because he did have a brain tumor late in his life, and it kind of messed up his thinking. But there was this weird this period of a couple of years where he was thinking a lot about his legacy, and I have all these emails from him, and I would go to lunch with him too, and he would tease me and be like, you have to come across the lakes. He lived in Abita Springs. Like, you got to come across the lake and help me write my memoirs. And I always wanted to, and I actually am scared to drive across the causeway, went by myself. But also because I'm from New York, and I didn't get a driver's license till I was like 30.
Right, right.
But so I never did it at the time. And he died in the summer of 2020.
Right.
Like right after the beginning of COVID. And I think there was the gambit where he had run his cartoon for a long time. He had a cartoon called Cayenne that was in Gambit. Mm. It was not Vic and Natalie. I think they asked Michael Tisserand, who was the former editor of Gambit, who has written a
Who's a book thief, Michael Tisserand.
He's a book thief. Yeah. What book did he steal?
Well, he stole
his own book.
Yeah, well, at the first book fest at Tulane University where I work, I caught him stealing a book.
Was it his book?
Yeah, because he said he needed it because he was doing a little press thing. And he was like fucking crazy, man. He was like, I was out there in front of the book.
That's what the book is called. It's called Crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what it's called. But anyway, I bust him stealing a book. He walked in with some friend of his, and he takes the book off the bookshelf and starts walking out of the bookstore where I work. And your wife was with me. And we saw him stealing the book, so I busted him big time.
I'm going to speak to him firmly.
Yeah, talk to him. Yeah.
We've spoken about it. Manny likes to make a big deal about it. He wasn't like sticking it under his jacket or something. He was more or less borrowing it for the purpose.
No, he wasn't, Renee. I saw it. You weren't there. I saw it. Oh. He took the book and was like, look at me. I'm stealing the book with his friend.
Okay.
We were giggling together two little fucking girls.
Okay.
I will tell Michael that he owes Tulane like $20.
Well, he apparently said he returned it.
He brought it back.
He said he returned it. Now, I don't know because I haven't seen the inventory, and it's been 2 years. I have no idea.
So I think, Michael wrote a book called Crazy about the cartoonist George Harriman, who invented Crazy Cat.
Right.
He's from New Orleans. He writes a lot about cartoons and comics, and he was the editor of Gambit. So there was this point when Bunny was definitely not long for this world, and the new editor of Gambit called Michael and said, do you want to prep an obit for Bunny? And Michael was like, no, you know who knows Bunny a little better is Allison. You should call her. And then I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, that's Bunny. It's so hard to put it all in one piece. Like, maybe we should call a bunch of people and get them all. And like, we were all just kind of kicking the Bunny obituary football around.
Yeah.
Like, possibly because it is so hard to sum Bunny up in one thing. Possibly
it's a big responsibility.
Because,
yeah.
Yeah, probably because no one wanted him to actually be dying. Like, and then, like, I think what wound up happening is, like, Doug McCash wrote the obituary in the end because, like, none of us did it. But I was talking to Michael back and forth, and I was like, you know what? Like, this is making me remember how Bunny, we had this joke where he was like, you're going to come write my memoirs for me. And I think I also had it in the back of my mind that I really like the Historic New Orleans Collections books. They do like really, really beautiful art books.
Yeah.
They have like, they did Ben Sandmel's Ernie Cato book, and they did this great Harold Batiste book. And I don't know, they have a wonderful like Second Line book, and it's all like big hardcover coffee table books.
Nice
with,
paper.
Like,
yeah,
like gorgeous illustrations. And I was like, maybe we should write Bunny's memoirs, except he's dead, so we have to do it like ourselves, and we should ask the Historic New Orleans Collection. And I think also probably years ago I had run into someone from there at like a cocktail party, and they were like, oh, if you ever have a book idea, you should call us, which was like a, just a polite thing to say
when
you run into a writer. But I was like, we should just do that. We should call them and say, would you like a book about Bunny Matthews? And it all, in the whole confluence of everything too, you know, his son Jude Matthews, who we're all friends with, was his creative executor. He got all the rights to his estate, which also meant he got like a giant garage full of disorganized paper. Because Bunny had lived in that same house in Abita Springs for like 40 years and kept everything. You know, he never flooded.
Yeah.
So it just all piled up and piled up and piled up, which is great for a biographer. But Jude also, I think Jude was about to have his second child, and he and his wife really wanted to get all this shit like out of their garage. So the whole confluence was like, you know, we called the H&OC. We were like, would you like this book? And also we have the artist's papers and they're available. And they went ahead and like they bought the book and they acquired the papers, and now they have this amazing Bunny Matthews collection in the archive at the H&OC, so scholars can go look at all his shit.
Right.
And they also immediately created merch for their gift shop with it, so now you can go into the gift shop and get like a little Bunny Matthews hat, a postcard or something.
Right. Cool.
But yeah, and we've just been spending I think the past year and a half talking to people about Bunny. And one of the great things about doing a project like that about someone his age, because he was, I think, not quite 70 when he died. He was almost 70. He was born in 1951. He died in 2020. Most of the people that hung out with him are still alive and still have good recall.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, I've almost been like having to like poke people away with a stick when they're like, I saw you were writing a book about Bunny Matthews.
Yeah, everybody,
let me tell you about Bunny Matthews.
Okay, well, that's nice.
So, yeah, it's taking a long time to talk to everyone. But, I mean, you know, like, and when you, like, go out to a bar, you go out during Mardi Gras, like, someone kind of lurches up to you and they're like, let me tell you about this thing that Bunny Matthews said in 1980, or
it's amazing how many people he touched, you know, whether he even knew them or not, you know, like just because he you know, New Orleans again is so insular, we're so self-obsessed, and you know, he really he spoke to that, you know, he gave voice to that.
Absolutely. And you know, I think the most important thing about the Bunny story, and I think why it has to be in a book, is that he is like a contrarian historical resource about New Orleans, because, you know, like we're starting to have, I know, you know, you probably noticed at the end of the 20-teens, everything was the 50th anniversary of some cool 60s thing, like the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love and the 50th anniversary of Woodstock and this sort of major, you know, height of the 20th century reminiscing period.
Right.
And with New Orleans, that's Tipitina's and Jazz Fest and like these things that have become like semi-ridiculous sacred cows. You know, that like, I mean, we still, I don't know, we still love them. Like, I love Jazz Fest. I go to Tipitina's. Like, I like WWOZ. But Bunny was, like, always kind of poking at all of that.
He would have the jaundiced eye to view these things with. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes, it's a certain amount of skepticism, even as we love these things and we recognize them all. But, yeah, it's not the sucker bait version. It's not the tourist version. You know, that's all the shiny part. I mean, we see the pretty part and the ugly underbelly.
Yeah, he would tell you the dirt, you know. Right. He would talk shit about Quint Davis. He would tell you about the time that, like, James Booker stole his credit card or something. Like, all these, like, magical stories that all these people in Hawaiian shirts come here every year to, like, revel in. Like, right. Bunny would be the one, like, I love this, but I also know the shitty side of it. And, like, I love that. And he loved that, too. He was just always willing to kind of twist the knife and tell the truth. And I think it's really important to have that on record.
Yes. Well, I'm really excited to see how the book turns out, and it's when I heard you were doing it, I was like, oh, I definitely got to get Allison on the show to talk about this.
Oh yeah, oh, I think it's going to be a great book.
Excellent, excellent. Well, while I have you, we're kind of on the downslope of the podcast here, but I thought, you know, as a lifelong writer, do you have any criticism of current writing, pet peeves about the style of music writing or just writing in general?
I think like right now, like my biggest pet peeve about the state of arts writing is that like it's disappearing. It's so bad. Like they just like laid off a million people at the LA Times. They just totally took Pitchfork apart. Like there's really no. There are very few venues for arts writing, and you lose, like, looping back to why Bunny was important. And I just gave a talk about this at the HNOC, at the newspaper symposium over the weekend, about the Figaro, which was where Bunny first worked. It's like...
It's kind of... Figaro was kind of the precursor to Gambit, in many ways.
And
when I was a kid, we had Figaro, which was really...
I was wondering if you were old enough to remember Figaro.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Figaro, and then kind of Wavelength was somewhere in there.
Well,
you know?
Wavelength was after Figaro, like, overlapping with Gambit.
Right.
Wavelength was, like, a pre-offbeat.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, it was maybe...
It was earlier 80s and offbeat started in the late 80s.
Yeah, Figaro is a counterculture kind of, like New Orleans version of Village Voice or something, you know.
Yeah. But, you know, you lose an incredibly important draft of history when you lose arts writing because especially when it's local arts writing like that. Like, there would be, I don't know, like, I mean, do you think, have you ever done an interview with anyone as long as an interview you've done with, like, Offbeat or something? Has anyone written an Iguana's story as long as... a local paper has?
Probably not.
Or like, I remember even going through the Offbeats and being like, Offbeat is a crazy resource because they wrote like 2,000 words on Iris May Tango or something. Like, no one would ever know that band existed.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's incredibly important for the historical record, but just overall in general, like...
Well, I've never heard of that band.
That was before your time, man. Oh. That's before you got here. Yeah.
But it is, it's just like such important documentation of just what people are doing and how they're feeling and what they're thinking. And music is always responding to what's going on socially. And it's in so many ways, like even like political stuff, but also the way things are moving around a town. Like you look at the listings and you're like, oh, all the clubs are in this neighborhood, but then they're in that neighborhood. You know, it's the historical record and you lose it. When you lose arts writing.
Oh, well. Well, fortunately, we have the Historic New Orleans Collection, and people who are still sponsoring this, not in a periodical form, but at least, putting money behind something that will be done well, and you'll something you can be proud of down the road, and you'll preserve all this. Important cultural, all these artifacts here,
and like all of Bunny's dirty jokes.
Yeah. Well, and he was he definitely had that side. So
what kind of name is Bunny for a man, though? I don't understand that at all. You know,
but actually, his real middle name was Bun, okay. like the coffee maker.
What was his real first name?
William.
William Bun.
William Bun Matthews.
B-U-N or
N.
B-U-double-L?
B-U-N-N.
Oh, okay. Well, his parents were freaky.
Family name,
I suppose. It was a family name. Yeah, it's like a Southern thing.
Yeah.
The middle name was a family name?
Yeah, my brother's middle name is my mother's maiden name. Yeah, it's not uncommon. People use
it. I never heard of that before.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, Allison, so excited to have you here finally. So excited to for this book to come out. Well, I guess... year or so we're looking down the road.
Yeah, probably later next year.
Nice. All right, well, fantastic. We'll all look for that, and thank you again for coming on the podcast.
Yes,
Allison.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. All right. Uptown.
And yeah, thanks for crossing Canal Street.
You know, I know Lefty would never do it.
It's not so bad over here. Well, shout out to Lefty. We love him and give him our best. And as always, in the Trouble Men podcast, we like to say trouble never ends.
But the struggle continues. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Money, bro.